Today is Monday, October 19th, 2020. This is part 8, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kurt. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing well.
Great. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. At the end of our interview last time, you had been talking with the superintendent of Olympic National Park. I think it was Jack Reynolds.
The superintendent of North Cascades was John Reynolds. The superintendent at Olympic was Bob Chandler.
Okay. Sorry about that. Thank you for the clarification. And so John talked to Bob. How did that work out that you were able to, at a very short notice, transfer out of North Cascades?
Well, I think it worked out because John and Bob were good friends and professionals, and they took care of their people. And I think it was coincidental that there was a vacancy in the East District Grand Jury at Olympic at the time.
Okay.
So that move was orchestrated in order to get myself and my family out of Stehegan.
And so that was basically a lateral move for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a GS-11 move.
From
must have been, because I'm sure it's done, but I don't think that John and Bob would have arranged for a transfer and a promotion without competition.
Right. Right. Okay.
Yeah, so it was probably GS-11 when I was in Stehegan.
Okay. Getting into Stehegan was quite a job. Was it that difficult to get moved over to Olympic?
No, not really.
I mean, no long boat ride, no float planes, all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, again, we had to use Tom Courtney's barge with a moving truck to come in. It was low lake level. Time of year, I think I mentioned in your previous interview, maybe not, that when they were loading the van, the moving van, onto the barge, I think my wife walked away just because it was too nerve-wracking. If that truck had tipped, it would have gone into the lake and all of our stuff would have been damaged. But
yeah.
Yep. In true Tom Courtney fashion, it worked. That was the only rough part, having the going away party and up at the Buckner Orchard and put our one Carmen Gia on the barge as well, and we left the pickup truck that we had purchased over in I don't know where it was, in the Spokane area. No, it was down by Wenatchee. Anyway, we sold that truck and just left it in there, as so many other vehicles are left by people that, you know. Did the 4.5-hour drive over to Olympic, and, well, actually, we probably had to go through Cedro Woolley and do all the paperwork and check out, and then headed over to Port Angeles and started work.
So, what were some of the challenges that you faced working at Olympic?
Well, the first challenge I faced was working for the chief ranger that didn't want to hire me.
Oh.
When I got to Olympic, they had a much stronger law enforcement program than I had come from, and he was looking for a fellow that wanted to do mostly law enforcement work. And that was some resource management work, such as coaching, and but his emphasis was on crimes in the campground and marijuana, drug use, and it wasn't my orientation, but the patrol vehicle that I was given, I rapidly christened Battlestar Galactica.
Ooh.
Because it was totally tricked out with every law enforcement communication system available at the time. All kinds of lights and sirens. The previous East District Ranger must have wired his own car. There were all kinds of bells and whistles in that thing, but it was just indicative of his relationship with the job being mostly law enforcement. He had good communication with the Port Angeles Police Department, the Calhoun County Sheriff's Office, and they were doing a lot of work with those agencies outside of the Park Service, outside of Olympic National Park.
Huh.
And
is that normal for national parks to sort of work on protection issues or law enforcement issues outside of their geographical boundaries?
Yeah, it's fairly common. Just like I was a deputized state game warden over in Stehekin.
I see.
Most of the rangers were deputized, I won't say most of the rangers. Several of the rangers were deputized sheriff's deputies. I don't really recall how many of them were deputized game wardens.
I guess that would make sense. I think of the tiny town of Tucson, Arizona, which is gateway community to South Rim Grand Canyon National Park, and lots of times the law enforcement in the park would respond to some sort of action outside the park in Tucson, bar fight or automobile accident, something like that.
Well, that was because at the time the sheriff's department had one sheriff deputy stationed at Grand Canyon / Tucson, and he lived inside the park. And so, yeah, mutual aid response was quite common. We frequently assisted the deputy with transport to jail down in Williams or Flagstaff. And that was common at Olympic. But I'm talking about more of the active. There were at least two rangers that were on the Clown County Drug Task Force. And a lot of the work that was done outside the park. Now, we had some drug use inside the park. Down on the southwest corner, we had a drug raid. Turned up some methamphetamine. But most of that work was outside in the county.
And that, again, thinking about it, it's like, well, that would make sense just because these are rural communities where resources are spread kind of thin and far apart. But I also kind of wonder, too, because park personnel could, as you say, spend a lot of time working on issues outside of the park if they weren't careful. And, you know, again, that's double-edged sword. It was good because you have good working relationships with surrounding agencies. But again, in shortages of manpower, you end up, you know, doing some another district's work or another agency's work.
Yeah, and it's a rough area. One deputy killed while I was there, and we had one Forest Service officer killed after I had left. So that's in the period of 15 years.
Okay.
It was a tough place to be as far as doing law enforcement with drugs and other work.
Okay. So it sounds like kind of a rough landing.
Well, yeah. The East District Rangers. So the East and West District is basically, you just divide the park north and south roughly halfway in the middle.
Okay.
And so the East District Rangers, there were four sub-districts there. We had around 12 full-time rangers just in the East District. And there was a welcoming party, and Mike Butler had that party at his house, and he and the law enforcement specialist took me aside at that meeting and said, you know, we know that you weren't the chief ranger's choice to be hired and that you were put in this position. We don't understand why, but we know that something was going on, and we are here to work with you.
Well, that's really nice.
And that was a major breakthrough. So we started working on programs that, in my perspective, are more appropriate for park service management. And there were fewer times spent, less time spent on drug enforcement outside the park and more time spent on wildlife protection. Poaching was a big problem on the west side, which I got more involved with when I became acting chief ranger, because then I had the entire park. But yeah, it was pretty much standard law enforcement with a lot of backcountry management. It was mountain goats. Was a big issue at the time with the Park Service wanted to eradicate the mountain goats because they were exotic species introduced many years before in the 1920s, I think by the state, for hunting opportunity,
okay.
Long before it became Olympic National Park. Bears, bear control, bears in campgrounds, your standard concession employee problems, basically the campgrounds were pretty smoothly run. There weren't too many problems, and in the backcountry, at that time, you needed to get a permit, but it didn't cost you anything.
Oh.
So, there's a backcountry permit office, backcountry seasonal, backcountry rangers. Every year, I would work together with Bruce Scott, who was a resource management specialist who was writing the wilderness management plan. And she and I would plan and coordinate the annual seasonal backcountry training. Very similar to the boatman training from Grand Canyon. And that was 2 or 3 days of training some 30 backcountry seasonals from throughout the park.
Nice.
And
this was, you mentioned Bruce Scott. Did I get her name right?
Ruth.
Thank you. Okay.
So, and the resource management crew primarily, Rich Olson was in charge of capturing, tagging, guarding the bighorn, the mountain goats.
How do you spell his name?
R-I-C-H-O-L-S-O-N.
Thank you. Yeah, the interesting thing about mountain goats is if you don't have a keystone predator to eat them and keep their numbers in control, then who's going to do that work? You know, how's that going to happen? How did you guys deal with that?
Well, prior to the time I got there, well, I didn't have anything to do with when I got there. Prior to the time that the park decided they needed to be eradicated, they weren't dealt with.
Okay.
There was no hunting in the park.
Right.
And they used it. The predators to take them down were few and far between. And so they proliferated, which resulted in the impacts to them. Vegetation, etc.
You bet.
Which is why the Park Service wanted to take them out. So that went on for years. And it was a highly contentious issue with PETA and other wildlife conservation organizations. And that gets into another influence of a congressman who was, his name might come to me, but that was during the time when I got there. Bob Chandler was the superintendent. After Bob left, a gal by the name of Maureen Finnerty came in.
How do you spell Maureen's last name?
F-I-N-N-E-R-T-Y.
Thank you.
And the congressman's name, last name was Dix, D-I-X. So, we had several meetings with the congressman. He told the superintendent that he was in favor of the eradication. And we were proceeding merrily along when an organization found a National Geographic article from, 1912, 1922, something, that talked about fur trappers trading with Native Americans, and they were given mountain goat pelts from the Olympic Peninsula, which turned out to be an incorrect story. But they gave that information to the congressman, and the congressman believed them and told the superintendent that she was lying to him, and that he wasn't going to support any funding for the eradication of the goats. All because of misinformation from the 1920s era report. So, that was about that. Spotted owl controversy was raging. loggers in the Forks area, one of the standard jokes was you could go to the store and get some, not hamburger helper, but some spotted owl helper. They were opposed to any protection of the owls because of the impact on the commercial logging.
Right.
And
did the park have any commercial logging? I'd assume that it didn't, but this would have been outside.
It was all outside.
Okay.
And one of the reasons that many of the loggers didn't like the park is because the park had locked up all the old growth.
Right.
Well, the park had locked up the old growth that was remaining.
Right.
And that's highly lucrative.
Yep.
We were involved with Forest Service on several different occasions on demonstrations. Again, Forest Service didn't have enough officers in the area for that type of activity. And so Rangers would offer mutual aid. So that went on for a couple of years. And then, I must have been three or four. And then the chief ranger retired. And they waited and waited for a year to advertise the job. But the superintendent put me in as the acting chief ranger, which I served in that capacity for 13 months. And during that time, they advertised the job and had brought in a new assistant superintendent. His name will come to me, Roger. Anyway, he had come from Yosemite. And I'm trying to remember his name. Anyway, so he came in and he had been assistant superintendent for about 6 months during the time that I was acting chief ranger for 13 months. And he was responsible for hiring the chief ranger position. And he hired another fella and told me that, well, I just don't think that you're a team player.
Wait a minute. He'd been there 6 months. You'd been there, certainly in the geographic area, quite a while and understood east side, west side, the issues. Okay.
So, I went back to being the East District Ranger. And that was a low point in my career, just, you know, emotionally, as far as career goes. You know, I fully expected to get the job, certainly after a year, 15 months of being in the acting position.
Right.
And let's just say I didn't behave properly. to the point where one of my good friends, Ranger at Olympic National Park, we were out doing something, and we were talking about it, and he basically said, you know, Kurt, it's been 6 months. You ought to quit acting like an asshole. And I said, is that bad, huh? He said, yeah. We'd like to have the Kurt back that was here. I said, okay. So, that was a real comeuppance coming from a very good friend. So I tried as best I could, knuckled down, and worked under the chief ranger that had been hired for exactly 2 years to the day that he was hired. And then he retired. And he had taken that job to get the pay grade.
Yeah.
And had to be in the job for 2 years to not pay for his move.
Huh.
And so on the day that he was hired 2 years later, he put in his retirement papers.
Was the deputy superintendent that had been pulled over from Yosemite still there?
Roger Rudolph, there you go. See, they come back after they think about it for a while. Huh. And Roger was a great guy. I mean, Roger and I were friends, stayed friends. And he was, he was a good ranger. And he was just looking for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Finally figured out. So the week after the retirement was announced, Maureen Finnerty and Roger Rudolph, superintendent, assistant superintendent, invite me into the superintendent's office, and they say, well, we'd like you to be acting chief ranger. I said, you have to be kidding me. I did chief ranger acting for 13 months, and you hired somebody else. Now you want me to be acting chief ranger again, and I'll do it if you're going to hire me. the Marine sat forward in his chair and looked at me and said, "Kurt, you know that I cannot pre-select someone. I'm asking you to be the acting chief ranger." Well, when Marine talked to you in that tone of voice, you knew that the argument or the discussion was over. So I said, "Okay, I'll be the acting chief ranger." And I think it was like 4 months later that I was hired as the chief ranger after competing for the job.
Nice.
So then things got even more fun for me because I was responsible for the entire park ranger program, which included the fire program. And the backcountry throughout the park, and we get actively involved on the west side with poaching patrol, and those are just the cats in the background.
Okay.
So, I forget all the years that went by, but we moved there in 1988. Bubby was four. September 7, yeah, April of 88, and transferred out of there in December of 2002. That was about 14 years. And mentioning when my son moved, when the family moved there, hired Damien and I, just to show you how isolated Stehekin was. Damien would have been 4 and a half. And the first time I took him to a grocery store, which was, I don't know, probably a Safeway or something like that.
Uh-huh.
With the automatic doors.
Yep.
We were walking up, and these automatic doors opened by themselves. And he literally sprung back about 2 feet.
Wow.
Because he had never seen those before. And when the change came down the little tray, you know, spins around the bottom with your pennies and your nickels from the grocery store bill.
Uh-huh.
That you're supposed to pick up, and oh, conveniently there's a donation box for charity right next to the tray.
Mm-hmm.
That money came down that tray, and it was right at his nose level.
Mm-hmm.
And he let out a whelp. And the cashier looked at him and looked at me, and I said, "He doesn't get out much. I don't think I said he doesn't get out much. They're not from around here," so something like that.
Hmm. So, you moved to the east side of Olympic, and were the district ranger there. When you were the acting, did you stay in the same housing? Then when you went back to be the district ranger, were you based out of the same place for that time?
Yeah. Headquarters for Olympic National Park is in Fort Angeles, Washington.
Okay.
When we transferred to Olympic National Park, it was the first park I had ever worked at. It was the first park I had ever worked at that did not have required occupancy for everyone.
Oh.
And so for the first time, at 38 years of age, roughly, we had to either rent or buy a house.
Hmm.
And since we were stationed in the Fort Angeles area, and many of the rangers on the east side lived in the Fort Angeles area, the town, we ended up staying with Richard Hansen in his Victorian home.
Okay.
For about a month until we found the place. And that was also at a time that my wife was pregnant with our second child, which had to be aborted after 6 months because of environmental poisoning.
Oh, wow.
Which amazed us because she lived in Stehekin, and there weren't that many incidents of environmental poisoning, but what the epidemiologist told us was that we had probably driven through a road where orchards were being sprayed in eastern Washington.
Wow.
And just ingesting that amount of air was enough to cause the damage to the fetus.
Wow.
Which both of us found incredibly unlikely because she just didn't go out that much out of Stehekin. But there was no other explanation that the epidemiologist could give us.
Wow.
You know, she didn't go poking around in old Buckner Orchard barns where there's probably chemicals from 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
Or any of that. So, so during that time we had to live birth the child that breathes for about 15 seconds. So not only we had a new location, we had just lost a child, we're looking for a house, I had a new job. But anyway, we ended up going and looking at a house before we had gotten the word about the baby. And we decided that a 3-bedroom house was too small. So we didn't make an offer. Yeah, this is an interesting story. So then we had to do the live birth abortion, whatever it's called. I guess it's not an abortion because we actually did a live birth, but it was induced labor. And they knew that the child was not going to live. So we were talking about this house, and said, you know, now that we're only going to have one kid, that house would be just right. Well, I had gone and looked at it, and Connor had gone and looked at it. So I said, okay, let's go back and look at the house. And we got our real estate agent and drove over to Raj and Verna's house. Now, Raj and Verna, Verna was from Vancouver, Canada. And Raj was American. And they had this house built by Verna's brother, probably in the 1980s. And had a beautiful garden in the back with about 14 fruit trees.
Wow.
And the master bedroom was about 6 feet longer and wider than most master bedrooms because the brother had figured out a way, at no increased expense, to build a larger master bedroom. Connor walked into that bedroom, looked out the large picture window overlooking the orchard and the garden. She said, "Does the backyard come with us?" I said, "Yep." She said, "Let's buy it." Well, we had walked in, and there was a signed offer laying on the counter for $500 less than full offer. And so we'd like to come back and take a little more look, but we're very interested in the room, in the house. And Raj said, "Well, let's just talk now." And Verna said, "Connor, come on, let me go show you the backyard." So we sat down at the kitchen table. And Raj was a World War II vet. And he said, "Kurt," and there was a mill in town owned by the Japanese. And the person that was offering to buy the house was in management and was transferring into the town and was Japanese. And Raj said, "Kurt, person that made an offer on this house made an offer on my house, not my home. I want you to buy this house.
Mm.
You make me an offer. And sharpen your pencil.
Hmm.
Okay, well, then I'm going to offer you $99,500. That's what you're asking for it. And about that time, Verna and Connor came back in. And I said, so how's it going, Rod? I said, well, I was hoping to get $100,000. You're only offering $99,500. Verna said, oh, I think that's enough money. And Rod stuck out his hand. That was the deal.
Wow.
And then he told me, I don't like Japs.
Mm.
He had spent years in the Pacific.
Oh.
And he did not want to sell his house in 1988 to a Japanese person.
Wow.
World War II vets hung on to stuff a long time.
Yeah.
And he was a nice man. He just had that particular bias.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were going to take a week-long vacation after we closed the deal. And they had a little dog, and they didn't know what to do with the dog. I suggested, well, how about if we just take care of your house? We'll live here, get out of Richard Hansen's care. So he agreed to it. And their kids, daughter and son, both thought they were crazy. Letting somebody who's going to buy your house live in it with no guarantee. You don't really know them. You had a couple cups of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, and stayed there for a week, took care of the place, took care of the garden. And when Rod and Vernon moved out, they left all of the gardening gear.
Oh, wow.
Including a rototiller. And he said, you can just have that. I know you'll take care of the place. So anyway, that was our first house. And required occupancy became a thing of the past as far as my career was concerned. So when I became chief ranger, acting chief ranger, I just stayed in the same house because it was literally a 4-minute drive to park headquarters.
Okay.
Of course, at that time in Port Angeles, it was no more than a 15-minute drive to any place in town. That's changed, but not by much. I was in Port Angeles a couple of years ago, and it's a thing. Well, I don't know if it is. It certainly looks like a failing mill town.
Hmm.
And I'm sure that if anybody listens to this tape and they live there, they'll be trying to get my address and write me hate mail. Cause it's a beautiful town.
Yeah.
Beautiful view. It's right on the Straits of Juan de Fuca. But it's 18 miles across the straits to Victoria. Vancouver Island, which is a gorgeous island. So, we lived there until 2002.
And the schooling for Cubby, just thinking about that versus Stehekin, I would assume it was quite the step up.
Well, so when we moved, he was 4 and a half.
Okay.
So he had not actually attended the school in Stehekin, the one-room schoolhouse with 8 or 12 kids.
Mm-hmm.
He went to a regular elementary school. I don't know how many kids were there, 400?
Yeah, okay.
Just been guessing. Still a small enough town, you're on a first-name basis with all the teachers. he did Montessori halfway between Port Angeles and Squim for a year. And then went to first grade. Or kindergarten. I guess he went to kindergarten. Had his, 12 years of schooling and graduated from high school in Port Angeles, I think, in 2002.
Okay.
Yeah, it's more interesting times. I'm way off track from Park Service.
Well, I was just thinking about the issues now that you're having to deal with versus a district ranger versus a chief ranger. You know, now you're seeing it all, it seems like. Resource protection issues, personnel issues, as you mentioned, concession employees issues, and backcountry issues. Did you learn to appreciate one job more than another? Was it easier to be a district ranger, or was the did you really appreciate the challenges that came with the chief ranger job?
I would say people always ask me, you know, what's your favorite park? And my answer is whatever park I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're all beautiful. They all have their issues. They all have their grandeur. I'd say the same thing about every job that I was fortunate to have. I had excellent supervisors. I had excellent people working for me.
Hmm.
And it just became on a grander scale. And the stuff that I witnessed, Marv Jensen having to handle with the River Unit Management Plan, and John Reynolds having handle with the writing of the firewood management plan and gravel extraction plan, trapping issues and interactions with the county commissioners and congressmen,
mm-hmm.
and Marine, well, Bob Chandler too, and Marine Kennedy dealing with the issues. As I became chief ranger, I was sitting in the offices with the superintendent. And so when these meetings or conversations were going on, so I developed a much greater appreciation for what they had to deal with. And I think it's the same, you know, you start out as a seasonal ranger and you're out there having a good time. And the district ranger is sending out memos, castigating the seasonal ranger, backcountry rangers at Rocky Mountain National Park for their liberal ways. And you don't really understand where the guy's coming from. And then you end up working in Stehek in the same place that he worked. And he was there 16 years before I was. And put up with a lot more of the issues that were a lot more strident at the time. So then you become the chief ranger, and you're exposed. Now you're dealing with all the other chiefs and resources and interpretation and administration and maintenance. And you start to develop an appreciation for how complex all of their jobs are.
Mm-hmm.
And you start sitting down in budget meetings, and you start thinking, you know, maybe I've got enough of the pot. Maybe I don't need to do this particular program right now.
Mm.
Maybe the maintenance guys need this extra $500,000. They've just been all very rewarding experiences.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like at that point, as the chief ranger, you're you're flying at 30,000 feet. You get to see the whole country, the whole, I mean, the whole operation, instead of just, okay, I'm going on patrol today, and this is, you know, this is where mm-hmm. I'm gonna see, which is a small area. Nice area, it needs protection, but you certainly don't get the bigger picture.
Right. And trying to pass that perspective on as the district ranger and the chief ranger to the seasonal backcountry mm-hmm. rangers at training. one of the big things was, what do we do with a dog in the backcountry? Well, by that time, I came to realize that, you know, dogs in the backcountry are prohibited, but you're never going to get rid of all the dogs in the backcountry.
Right.
So, just deal with the issue, and if the people are cantankerous, and you're a seasonal ranger, and you're not commissioned, all you do is make contact and try and make a friend, and then, you know, call it in, and maybe somebody that is commissioned will meet them at the trailhead.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's fun to look back and think about how adamant we were about some things, and on the big scheme of things, that guy making an illegal river trip down the Grand Canyon wasn't really that big a deal, from 30,000 feet or 60,000 feet.
Yeah.
And certainly not from Congress and the Senate, when they've got lobbyists and constituents visiting them in Washington, D.C.
Right. Yeah. How was Connor handling all this?
Well, he handled it very well in Stehekin, and I think I mentioned that the community itself was very respectful of Connor and Gubby.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were respectful of me as well, up until Eddie showed up.
Mm-hmm.
But they had their own points of view. But, you know, Connor was learning to weave and all kinds of things, and she was a crafts person, and she was a master at leather work, and created all kinds of beautiful costumes for various women in the valley.
Hmm.
And then when she got to Port Angeles, it was actually a community of, you know, how many people were there? 15,000? And she pursued her own interests, ended up becoming a massage therapist, opened her own business in downtown Port Angeles.
Wow.
Was very involved in the women's drum circle. So she was handling it very well, and Gubby was having a great time until he hit high school.
What happened there?
My opinion, what happened there is his testosterone didn't set in until one or two years after everybody else's testosterone set in.
Okay.
And he had been raised to be respectful and kind.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran into a lot of boys that were not respectful and were not kind.
Mm.
And so he withdrew. And he ended up with three very good friends, all of which were computer geeks.
Okay.
And that's how they spent their time. Although, I wanted to be a professional baseball player, and I think I may have passed some of that perceived failure off on my son, because I became an avid little league dad. Not the kind of dad that sits in the stands and yells at the umpires, or yells at the kids, which is just amazing to me. But I was an assistant coach for a couple of years, and then after he went from Little League to Junior Babe Ruth, I became a coach of the Little League team. He ended up, I took him to, there were a couple of old codgers, we'll call them, whose names will come to me, that one of them had actually played on a traveling minor league team in the 40s for the pros, trying to get in the pros. And anyway, these guys knew baseball. And there's a transition from Little League to Junior Babe Ruth. You know, you can lead off instead of having to keep your foot on the bag until the ball is pitched. You can slide head first. You're expected to turn double play. So they would put together a training session for the 12-year-olds coming out of Little League going into Junior Babe Ruth every spring. And Mr. Mudd, that's his name, was coaching everybody about leading off at one of these sessions, which I dropped Cubby off at, Damien. And so you're supposed to lead off with your, you know, your right foot striding out and close up. You don't hop off the base. Well, of course, first time Cubby went out there, demonstrated how he was going to lead off, he hopped out off the base. And Mr. Mudd walked over to him and said very strenuously, sternly, "Young man, are you listening to me?" And of course, here's this old codger who just scared the hell out of his 13-year-old. So, you know, he told me later, he said, "Yes," I said, "Yes, sir. Get back on the base and do it right." So I did it about three times. "Okay. I don't want to ever see you hopping off the bag." "Yes, sir." So I picked him up from practice and gets in the car, and the first thing he says is, "Dad, there's no way I can't be on Mr. Mudd's team. He's terrible." "Okay, what happened?" So he told me. Well, sure enough, Mr. Mudd drafted him. And Cuddy played the outfield. And I mentioned the testosterone. He ended up, they needed 12 boys to go to form a all-star team when they were 13 years old, 13, 14, and 15. And they only had 8 or 9. And so they called me up and said, "Would Damien be interested, would Cubby, he's known as Cubby, would Cubby be interested in playing on the all-star team?" I said, "Yeah, I think he would. I'll ask him." "Hey, Cub, you want to play on an all-star team?" "What's an all-star team?" "This is what you do." "Well, yeah, sure, I can do that." So he was placed on the all-star team, and some of the kids that he ran into later in high school were on that team. A couple of them had run into the law when they were around 18, 19, so... Anyway, that Little League team from Port Angeles, Washington, 1986, I guess it was, went to the World Series.
Wow.
Finished fourth in the nation.
Wow.
And the next 2 years, they always went to at least state, and I think twice they went to regionals. And that's as far as they got. So he played baseball, and he was not in the starting lineup. And I look back on it now thinking, you know what? After that first year, I could tell, if I think back, I could tell that he wasn't really having a good time. And I think it was more his dad wanting him to be on a baseball team.
Ah.
So that's a lesson that I learned in hindsight. The other part about that is after I coached Little League, I became a Little League umpire. And then after he finished Junior Babe Ruth, I became the chief umpire for Junior Babe Ruth. And I had to recruit kids to be umpires. They got paid $5 a game.
Hmm.
And I had sent myself to umpire school, and I made a couple of friends there and invited them up for two successive years. And we put on a one-day umpire school for high school baseball players.
Oh, wow.
And that's who we recruited. And Cubby became an umpire. And that's one of my happiest days, one of my happiest Father's Day, is he and I umpired two baseball games together.
Nice.
And I took home plate on the first game, and he took home plate on the second game. And the dads were yelling at the kids. The dads were yelling at the umps. And I just looked at Cubs and said, you know, it's a pretty good Father's Day when I can be out here on a baseball field with you. And we're umpiring, and that idiot in the stands is yelling at you. He said, yeah. Just let it go, Dad.
Hmm.
So, that was I think one of the reasons that many people, not just Rangers, tend to stay in Olympic National Park for a long time is half of you are living in the Port Angeles area, and there's actually a town there.
Yeah.
And you don't have to drive an hour to get to the hospital to birth your child. Drive an hour to get to the grocery store, or send a blank check in the mail to Safeway.
Right.
Get your groceries delivered on a boat. So it balances out. Yeah, so that was Port Angeles.
Nice. Yeah, I wonder, I think it would help with community buy-in that, you know, you are living in the town. You know, your wife is actively engaged in the community. I think it kind of helps make Park Service employees more,
mm-hmm.
integral parts of the community, and it helps the community understand more about the Park Service and how that works.
Yeah. Yeah, you become a known entity rather than an authority.
Right. Yeah.
So, of course, there were other communities on the west side that didn't feel that way about Park Service folks. There were actually stores and bars that Forest Service employees and, by association, Park Service employees would not be served.
Hmm.
So you just didn't go in those stores. There were certain bars that you did not go to. But those are rougher days.
Yeah.
Times are changing.
What else do you remember about Olympic? Some of the things that you did that you look back on now and we're really, really glad that you did them. Program development or certain issues that came up and how you handled those.
I'm really glad that we created a strong illegal hunting and anti-poaching program on the west side of the park.
Nice.
I had some very dedicated Rangers, and we're able to staff them with seasonals longer into the fall. That was one of them. I think I ended up getting more funding for the West Side programs. And it's, you know, it's pretty standard. If headquarters is on the east side, or then the west side is not going to get the attention.
Mm.
If headquarters is on the north side, then the south side is not going to get the attention. And, you know, that's where the administration is. That's where they're focused.
Right.
And it takes, you know, 2.5 hours to get out to your northwestmost sub-district. You don't get out there very much.
Right.
Let's see, two other things that I'm proud of. I'm proud to hire, permanent female ranger at Olympic. Annie Lustig, put her out on the west side. And not sure that pride is the right term, at least fortitude. My tree collection manager came to me as I was chief ranger and told me that she thought that somebody was stealing from the campground deposit boxes. So you fill out your little envelope and put your money in that. And so we did a 2-month surveillance program and ended up putting together enough information that the Elwha sub-district ranger was cited into court. They stripped him of his legal authorities and told him he was on administrative leave while we completed the investigation. He resigned 2 days later. And it took about 6 months, but we were able to put him in jail for 8 months.
Huh.
And sitting in the courtroom with our prosecutor / law enforcement officer, his legal clerk, Kim, who later became superintendent of Glacier, I think, and a couple other district rangers. And hearing the judge just lambast this former park ranger and call him off and being a cheat and betraying his fellow rangers was a rewarding case. And I got calls from throughout the country from other rangers thanking me for pursuing it rather than just allowing the person to resign, which had happened for the past 20 years on different occasions that they knew about that I didn't know about.
Interesting.
So, relationship with the resource management unit, I think a relationship with the maintenance unit. In fact, when I transferred to Joshua Tree after Olympic as the superintendent, the first thing that called all the staff together and I told them, look, you know, I come from the ranger ranks, but every division here is of equal importance.
Mm.
And you might have a patrol car, but you can't drive it on the roads if the roads aren't maintained. And none of us would be working here if we weren't getting paid. So administration is kind of important, too. So I just think that probably started in Stehekin with John Reynolds and John Jarvis. But the recognition came in Olympic that all of them are integral parts to making the park run.
Yeah.
And, as a buck ranger, you know, you're up there in the clouds, hiking down the trail, thinking you're the coolest thing on earth.
Mm.
Well, firefighters and trail dogs, whatnot. They're out there working just as hard as you are.
Right, the packers and the maintenance guys that are working to clean out the Roto-Rooter sewer machine and,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody. The people that
it's basically Rocky, Olympic, Joshua Tree. You're basically, your town, and maintenance workers are the water district or the electrical company or whatever.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you're basically running a town.
Nice.
It has a bunch of transients.
Yeah, especially with the seasonals that are coming and going and, you know, short-term hires. And
talking about the trip.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Stayed for 3 days, did ya? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, it was a cumulative impact, but I think Olympic, maybe the proudest thing I could say is that I realized that the whole park unit, all the employees are integral to making things work.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Nice. Well, maybe this is a good place to wrap up this part of the interview. And we'll pick up Olympic, and then at one point you're going to head to Joshua Tree. Is that how that's going to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
For the final hurrah.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that sound like a plan where we're at here?
Yeah. Yeah. Wrap it up. I don't have much else to add about Olympic, but it sure was a good time.
Yeah. Nice. Well, I just kind of want to make sure we don't leave Olympic too fast. Because you were there, it sounds like, you know, 12 years. That's you know, the longest in your career that you stayed in any one park. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's a lot of other stuff. And walking down the hall and looking at the calendar here and thinking, you know, I think I got 4 Rangers, honorary awards from the director of the Park Service for their bravery.
Wow.
And, during that time. And it just, thinking back on it, just indicates that dedication that these folks had. So.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll pick that thread up next time, and as with that, this will conclude part 8, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Kurt Sauer. Today is October 19th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Kurt, thank you so very much.
You betcha.